So today we're going to continue, but really just continue and open up more of the conversation around some of the challenges that we discussed last time. We started talking about genetic disorders. I know it's been a little bit of a while, but even if you missed the previous one, you're in good shape for today. But so just to catch all of us up and to remind ourselves, so we spoke about the challenge of a couple that either wants to learn or has learned about a potential genetic anomaly in that pairing, in that match. And so we talked about everything from testing to possible solutions. And we explored all of that, Dor Yesharim and not Dor Yesharim, and all of those different kinds of things. So what I want to do is to look a little bit at the beginnings of this, in terms of it raises so many different questions. There are so many different kinds of solutions that are out there, and I want to look not just at the question of a couple that has a potential for genetic anomalies, disorders, etc., but also at the question of a couple struggling with infertility. It happens to be also that Racheli Sprecher Frankel's visit this Shabbat is co-sponsored by our USAID initiative, which I have some sort of connection to through my wife, as well as, there you go, and also in commemoration with, there's an organization called Yesh Tikva that raises awareness about sensitivity around couples suffering with infertility, and Racheli is actually going to be addressing that as well in her class as USAID Halacha, and we're doing it in conjunction with that as well. So that's also very relevant, obviously, to this, and I've Unfortunately, my wife even more so, have had the opportunity to work with couples that are experiencing this. And it goes without saying that difficulties are really tremendous. Obviously, emotionally, financially, in this country, it's tremendous. Just by comparison, in Israel, as with other differences, this is all covered under the healthcare, actually. It's very interesting. And so it's relatively affordable to go ahead with fertility procedures, actually, in Israel. In America, it can cost upwards of $15,000, $20,000 per round of in vitro fertilization. And the success, last time I checked, was very often in the 15 to 20% range. So you're talking about very often going through many of these kinds of cycles. And so you're talking about prohibitively.
Each, for each one, 15%.
Yeah, for each, all
each
things
round.
Being equal, for each round. So in other words, most couples, if the IVF is going to be successful, are going to need to go through this process. Multiple occasions, the emotional stresses are extraordinary. The financial stress done by young couples, young families, I mean, without having been able to build, you know, sort of independent wealth or anything even close to that very often, it's just so challenging. And then on top of all of that, there is a host of ethical and halachic issues that this raises. And we could spend many months going over this. And there's so many, really, for the last 30, 40 years, Poskim have been grappling with so many different questions, right? And we can even begin to open it up. So what might be any of the procedures and be attendant questions that you might imagine would have to be addressed? Just shoot away. What do you think?
I was just thinking it's a good thing that the status, the religious status, is determined by the mother, because at least the mother is a known.
Good, yeah, and that's going to be relevant. Although there are questions that are relevant to paternity that we're going to actually have to start to look at today. Right? So what's dependent on paternity? So Jewish status is dependent on the mother. That's definitely true. But there are questions of paternity, right? So if you want to know your yichus, kohen levi, etc., so that's going to depend on questions of paternity. How do we define that? That's right. So you have someone who donates sperm, right? So if that becomes the father, or you have all sorts of different challenges, right? So, for example, if you have a couple where you have a man and a woman and they're not able to conceive together, and you have a male sperm donor, right, and who's not Jewish or not a Kohen, there's a major dispute as to actually the preference there, and we'll talk about that as we go along, but quite likely won't be a Kohen. The apparent father, though, is a Kohen. right? How do you, you know, how do you deal with these kinds of things in shul, right? These are incredibly embarrassing, right? Or the opposite. Yeah, absolutely.
What about a
mom's there? This is very, very serious questions about ichos and who you can marry and so on and so forth. When it comes to sperm donors, there's a major dispute among the poskim that erupted really first and foremost between Rav Moshe Feinstein and the Satmar Rebbe initially as to whether we prefer Jewish or Gentile sperm donors, which is a fascinating kind of question.
Because of genetics or because of...
So there's a more mystical argument for not preferring a Gentile sperm. If you say, like, well, there's a certain sanctity of the Jewish people and so on and so forth. So that was the Satmar Rebbe's argument. The other argument is more of a traditional halachic argument, which is to say if you have a Jewish sperm donor, ironically, actually, you end up with more yichus questions than you have when you have a non-Jewish donor, because then you have the Kohen Levi Israel question and so on and so forth. And we're going to talk about it's actually complicated halachically for a whole host of reasons. So maybe you actually prefer the Gentile sperm donor. It's very interesting. I don't know if it's almost uncomfortable to talk about, but I'm sure that many saw the story a couple of years ago about the sperm donor who did so on many, many, many occasions. It was a little bit of a side gig for him.
The physician
is right. There was a doctor. It was reported, I don't know, maybe 3-4 years ago or something like that. In the last time. He sired, I don't know, upwards of like 24 children or something like that. I don't know the exact number.
And it's a sibling issue.
So you say halachically, the sibling issue. But this was he gets paid for every single donation that he makes. And so this was a side business. You'll forgive me for saying so, but that's can you imagine?
It was a financial incentive,
right? Can you imagine?
So in Israel, if you donate sperm, you say whether you're a Kohen or a lady, but here you don't. Like, I'm sure it's not in the sperm bank information.
It's probably not legislated as such. Yeah, and then there are other issues, by the way, and even in Israel, in terms of, I'm sure some have also seen some of these interviews with couples where there was a mistake.
What kind of mistake?
Where you had surrogacy, but the wrong egg was implanted into the mother. These are right. I mean, but there have been, you know, I remember there was, a 60 Minutes, they did an interview with a from Christian couple, and the mother decided to carry. She found out relatively early on that it was a mistake. They told her at the lab, or a doctor, whatever it was, and she decided to carry someone else's child to full term on religious grounds, both as a matter of moral principle, and also they're committed Christians, and so the abortion
was
not an option.
It wasn't really surrogacy, it was just an artificial surrogacy.
It was an accidental surrogacy, that's correct. It was not an intended surrogacy.
Wow.
And so you have these kinds of scenarios. There's a fascinating institute in Israel. I'm familiar with the Pua Institute, Mahon Pua. Is that a familiar name?
Yeah, from Pua.
Okay. And there's one of the people who's involved there who often does the sort of North American or Anglo relations piece of it, because he's from a South African background. This is someone by the name of Rabbi Gideon Weitzman, whom I'm not sure if anyone has heard of him, but he happens to have a brother here in the community by the name of Matt Weitzman.
Wow.
So if you know Matt, that's his brother. Another.
Is this his twin?
What?
Is this his twin?
I don't believe they're twins. Does Matt have a twin?
Yeah.
I didn't know that they're twins. I never heard that. I think that it's not a twin, but I don't know for sure. But I do know that they are siblings. So, natural siblings to the best of my knowledge. So the Gideon Weitzman works at Machon Pua. And he actually delivered a course to rabbis that I participated in a number of years ago on the halachic and pastoral aspects of guiding a couple through the process of infertility. This is what he does on a daily basis. And one of the topics that they discussed was actually they have a concept of a mashkiach. except it's a mashgiach that works in a rather different capacity than what we typically think of when we think of a mashgiach. It's not someone who checks to see whether or not the food is kosher. It's someone who's specially trained in a laboratory. Kid you not, they train people. Apparently they have very high halachic standards in terms of who they accept and so on and so forth to make sure that there are no mistakes that are made in the lab, because there have been very highly publicized cases, even with the most professional of laboratories, that have had confused mistakes where the wrong egg was implanted into the wrong woman. And so halachically, their poskim have determined that that level of oversight is insufficient. So they add their own mashgiach, and they specially trained and so on and so forth. I discussed this last night with our other group, and Phyllis Goldman said that she once actually looked into whether or not she could, I don't know, at some point it came up, and she was thinking about training to do this, and she looked into the criteria, and apparently they're extremely strict. She said you have to be makbid on, like, chalav Israel and like all sorts of things. Like, what are you talking? I told you to give the profile of the great mindset. Okay. Now I assume that it gets back into like the politics of conversion and so on and so forth, where they absolutely allow a woman to do it, just like a woman could be a mashgiach, 100%. There's no question about that. Moshe Feinstein has a well in tshuva about that. Absolutely trained women, thus she was looking into it. So I don't know if that's the case, or, you know, that's because there's a certain Haredi population that's dependent on this, and they're trying to accommodate that as well. And so it gets into the usual complications in the Israeli Jewish community. There are, and we're only touching on the tip of the iceberg today. I mean, there are all sorts of questions. And we'll talk a little bit about the sources about paternity, which we'll come to in just a few moments. But there are certainly questions of maternity as well that we're going to have to look at too. And here you have a very basic question that arises, right? What are the two basic options in terms of halachically how we might define motherhood?
The one who carries the child.
Good, so the gestational mother, excellent.
The one who donates the egg.
That's right.
They didn't know that then in ancient times. They didn't know about eggs till relatively
right, well, right. So but I'm saying contemporary post-com, yeah.
And I would say even the mother who adopts the child.
Okay, so we talk about adoption as a related but separate question, but yeah, the question of gestational versus, right, the donor, or what we might call the genetic parent, right, is a live issue and has been hotly disputed by Poskim and has been shifting, I would say. I would say that initially, by which I mean probably 30 to 40 years ago, there was a greater halachic consensus on the side of the gestational mother. And it has slowly but surely inched, I think, so I don't know if it's a consensus, I wouldn't say, but I would say a greater percentage of poskim have moved toward a genetic understanding of parenthood, of motherhood, which is fascinating to see how...
Legally, also, secularly.
Oh, for sure, there... No, not at all. That's a conversation. Yeah, 100. And there it's even, I think, even sharper, 100%. You know, even in other areas, you know, right, the Kohen gene, that would be an interesting thing to see if... I am told that the Kohen gene, I'm told by scientists that the Kohen gene is really, really rigorous in terms of 98% or something to that effect, that it's a really... And you would know probably better than
that. No, there was a book a few years ago that came out that was...
But I understand that there's an article in Nature about it. In other words, you know, peer-reviewed scientific journals and so on and so forth. I haven't seen any post-gim who discuss whether or not that's something that we rely on for, you know, halachic purposes. But Brave New World, I think, would be interesting.
Submit a blood type before you get an aliyah.
All right, that's it. Every shul that you want, a little frick, okay? Save a life and save a Kohen.
So you thought you were a Kohen.
Right? All right, Mr. Katz. Right? Kohen, etc. See if you're the real deal. So that's interesting. Another thing, by the way, that I haven't seen in the post-gim, to move to... Well, I'll come back in a second, sorry. Just on the side topic of the genetic... relying on genetic information for halachic purposes, this has come up in other contexts. And one case I know where it has been relied upon to significant halachic effect is in cases of aguna. Aguna, not in the contemporary sense of a Kohen, of a man who refuses to give the wife a get, but I mean the classical case in which we don't know whether or not the husband has died, and we want to establish that he has tragically passed away so that we can allow his wife to remarry. And so after 9/11, for example, there were poskim, a prominent poskim kohen from the Beis Din of America, a prominent based in New York, that at least in part relied upon genetic samples in order to allow women to remarry. At that time, it was considered to be more of what we call a secondary rather than primary halachic basis. They used dental records as well and facial recognition and so on and so forth in order to establish that. But my impression is that over the course of time, it has taken greater and greater prominence in terms of the halachic process as the science has been confirmed and it becomes more mainstream and so on and so forth. So the genetic piece is starting to loom larger in the halachic community, which I think is fascinating when it comes to defining maternity.
And, Rabbi Avram?
Yeah.
Right. So he spoke at the Young Israel many years ago, mm-hmm. after 9/11.
Okay.
And if I'm not mistaken, I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Does anybody else hear it? I think he said that the husband was presumed alive unless proven.
Okay, but you can prove it with genetic. The well, point is, if you have a genetic match.
Well, what if they didn't have genetic stuff from everybody?
Yeah. No, for sure. I'm not saying it's a simple matter. Although, to the best of my knowledge, they were able to resolve all of those cases, and this is why there was a book that was
all those thousands of people. They were able to discover.
Well, I mean, they were not all Jewish. I mean, the ones, you know, among those who were Jews.
But who identified.
I
understand that they were able to resolve all those cases. And there are circumstantial factors that can sometimes together with, I mean, quotes can get creative. And they work, you know, they work. They work.
I was struck by it because as I think I learned that after the Holocaust, it was the opposite. That mm-hmm. the presumption was that the husband was dead.
I see.
Because nothing was left.
There was no way to get
right.
maids.
Yeah.
Well, but if you... I'm not saying... The very fact that someone had a job working at the World Trade Center and then was missing, in of itself, I think you're right, would not be sufficient. But what we do is we will track down every plausible lead and endlessly work. There was a book that was published by the Beis Din of America reporting their findings and going over the halachic argumentation. And they actually went over all this. There is a larger book. That's the best of my knowledge. There were others.
I've heard the same thing, that there's no outstanding Aguna issues from 9/11.
Yeah, and I will say as well that there are other halachic heroes that that have dedicated themselves, at great, either personal risk in terms of in the halachic community, they're going out on a limb and taking a position, or just the endless amount of time that it takes in order to do the research. So, for example, the namesake of Yeshiva University's Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak. Yitzchak Elchanan is named after Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, who is a great posek. And my understanding is that one of his great legacies was his willingness to go overboard to resolve whatever he needed to do in order to resolve cases of Aguna, and that was, I believe, was one of the primary motivating factors in the fact that the yeshiva was named after him, that he blended halachic commitment with a certain humaneness and compassion in a way that was authentic to the halachic tradition, really quite heroic. And then another was Rav Avadia Yosef, who was the Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel after the Yom Kippur War, 1973. And the first line of defense was almost all students in Yeshivot Hesder. Those are the ones who went first. I know from Gush there were, I think, 8 students who died in that first wave, and they were all, they kind of held the enemy at bay. And Rav Amital, one of my teachers, lost 8 students, and it was a very traumatic experience. And then after that, many of those young soldiers were married, young married soldiers, young children, and home and so on and so forth, and Rav Avadia worked again, well more than overtime to resolve, I don't know all those cases, but to resolve those cases. Rav Goren was involved in that. Rav Goren was even more controversially involved in that.
at risk to his own life.
Right. So that wasn't for Aguna, though. Just to be, that was cases. I mean, that was heroic, absolutely, as well. That was more for the purpose of Kever Yisrael, of being able to give them proper burial. Absolutely. He had another case of Mamzeros,
yeah,
that he, very, no, not exactly the same kind of case of Aguna, but very famously or infamously, depending on your view, resolved right around the time that he became the Ashkenazic chief rabbi in parallel to Rav Vadia Yosef. And that was a real breaking point for many in the Israeli rabbinate, actually. That was a very difficult moment, but yes, he allowed these, the Langer brother and sisters, be considered to be free to marry and at great personal risk, and that was a major controversy. Anyhow, that's just touching the surface, and there's a little bit of an aside, but also just scratching the surface in terms of the so many questions that arise around sperm donation and IVF. What I want to talk about just today is really two issues. Number one is this question, the question of establishing paternity, we'll talk about, and in a very unusual case from the Gemara, I ask everyone to kind of suspend your scientific assumptions for ERDC in source one. But also to look at the question of the couple using IVF combined with PGD, which we say is pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, which is that we can now do genetic tests of the embryo in the Petri dish and actually establish the genetic composition of the of that egg, and to actually determine whether or not this child, if implanted back into the mother, would suffer from T-sex, you know, the BRCA gene, you know, and so on and so forth. How have Poskim responded to that? Because the same technology allows us to choose designer babies, right? And eugenics, basically, all over again, and so on and so forth. So how do we handle that whole piece? So those are the two questions I want to touch on today with the time that we have remaining, but we'll be able to continue the conversation.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not an X-linked. I mean, it's on the X chromosome. So men who have the BRCA gene, they can obviously transmit it. And actually, if somebody who's twice BRCA, say, get BRCA for both, that's a lethal mutation.
Yeah.
That child doesn't go. And men with the BRCA gene have an increased risk for male breast cancer, a slightly increased risk. They also have an increased risk for, I think it's just BRCA 2 for prostate cancer.
But it's very low incidence in men, but you can have breast cancer.
But it is above the baseline, yeah.
And Spartan?
There actually is a lot of BRCA gene in Spartan, and in fact it's been found in Indian, as in Native American Indian, the Southwest, and they think some of it might be, I've heard, like Marana juice from the Spanish. Yeah.
That's what they said.
That's possible. I've heard that.
That's interesting. Yeah. One thing, I mean, yeah, I always heard about I always heard all about Ashkenazi, you know, and so on and so forth. And so because of that, I feel like I'm relatively ignorant, frankly, around the Sephardic genetic, you know, commonalities. And it's, they exist as well. But I was never well educated about it. I am from an Ashkenazic background.
But I don't think it's like, you know,
a high incidence.
The, you know, I don't know, it's rock. I think it's more like Spanish.
The European.
Mm hmm.
See, another time, but an implication.
Here, two BRCA, 1-2 founder mutations in Jews of Sephardic origin. Here's a whole PubMed thing. Isn't it amazing?
Wow.
We suggest adding these two to the five mutations included in the Jewish panel of BRCA 1-2 mutations.
Yeah, well, one of the things I was going to add, and I hear what you're saying, one of the things that was
this
striking...
Again, Iberian Peninsula.
Interesting.
It's not like... I'm not aware of Eidot HaMizrachel, though it's possible.
But Spain, that makes sense.
Yeah. And one of the things that I learned is interesting that we did, when Tova and I were... we're dating, we did in our own independent panel of testing. We didn't do Dori Sharm or anything like that. We did all of that. And the doctor had a fascinating recommendation. He said, I'm giving you the full battery. We did like 37 or something like that. A very, very high number. And he said, I want you guys to do this again in, I forget the exact number of years, like 5 to 10 years. because in the meantime, we're going to learn about new disorders. We're going to be able to test for new disorders. And he recommends, that OB recommends to all the young couples who, you know, he's the doctor for the woman, to go back and to be retested even later on, which is almost unheard of in our community. I mean, really, but I think is one of the more intelligent things that I've heard suggested around this topic. Right. Right, but you never hear this, right? It's not part of the... It's not for other conversations. Yeah, Emily, please.
The BRCA gene, and again, it comes up in my mind with regard to the whole question of the opportunity to design a baby, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So very tragically, I mean, so far so good, but a very good friend of mine, her daughter in her 30s, has breast cancer. They discovered that both the daughter and now my friend, who is my age, but both have the BRCA gene. This has affected her very deeply. And she said, you know, Emily, I'm starting to think that Jews should marry. I'm starting to think of supporting intermarriage with conversion. Because how are we going to break this cycle?
Mm-hmm.
So I naively said to her, I said, well, maybe the rabbis could encourage Sephardi Ashkenaz.
Mm-hmm.
but
and it was naive not only because of the information we just learned, but also because that's also considered
that.
Intermarriage by too many.
Yeah,
so
for BRCA gene, you need just one parent to have it. Intermarriage.
Yeah, I was gonna say it doesn't end the BRCA.
Yeah.
I think
like,
is that true on both? That's true on both.
The people of women who are at increased risk for breast cancer from BRCA carry just one gene. From one parent, because if they carry two genes from two parents,
it's
like asex, it's lethal.
So
they're never born.
So
they're not
even born.
The sense that they're not even born.
And it's primary, not recessive. It's primary and not
it's
only
primary,
recessive.
Not recessive.
Well, it's
so
both
I,
in a way.
Yeah.
I will tell my friend about this, but
right,
it was very painful because she was just so upset.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, so since you're talking about.
Yeah, no,
I thought, how should Jews handle this?
I mean,
we are who we are. Is that the answer?
I mean, it's a hard, inbreeding does come at a certain cost. And by the way, what's interesting is that some of the Rishonim who explain some of the reasons for some of the incestuous relations to your immediate relatives explain that. And this we're talking the Middle Ages, explain this on the basis of medical reasoning. So they knew something.
They knew something.
They knew
they
something.
Observed what was happening.
That's
right.
They were right.
That's
exactly right. So there is awareness and sensitivity of this. Everything is a balance. So obviously, intermarriage comes with a whole other set of.
I
understand.
Really serious,
but I can understand. I can understand emotionally. But that's where some of the fertility treatments, which are far from ideal, I know. But it's striking and almost again miraculous that's. That's one part of the solution for sure. All right, so one of the questions that comes up, one of the easier questions, but it comes from such a fascinating set of discussions and is always brought in as part of these conversations that I think it's worth looking at. And you find a pattern, you find these stories in the Gemara or comments in the Gemara that seem so far-fetched. And you see this when you read the Hebrew and the English. And it's like, really? And then all of a sudden, they come back thousands of years, 1,500 some odd years later, and you say, oh my God, whatever the science was then and however they understood that, this actually, if you take not the case, but the underlying concept, it has shockingly relevant practical ramifications, almost as if the rabbis were giving us the raw information to deal with the revolution that we are undergoing, the fertility revolution we are undergoing, to give us the materials with which to think about these things. So this week we'll talk about one of those. In a future week we'll talk about other ones where the rabbis talked about in utero, children that changed gender. Right,
whoa.
Right, and then, right, so then the question, because that seems, whoa, what does that mean? According to one series of Midrashim, Dina, Yaakov's daughter, was actually going to be a boy, and then there was a prayer, and then she switched genders in utero. So what does that mean, right? Okay, so we can have a whole discussion about what the Midrash means, but then there's a whole discussion on the medical ethics side to say, wait a second, that could have implications right? Gestational versus, wow, that's right. It's just fascinating. So we're going to look at that one also. But for today, we have the Gemara's concern in Chagiga that Chayshinan Shema Be'ambati Ibra, that we are concerned that a mother may have become impregnated, might have conceived in a bathhouse. Now, right? Last night, we had a number of doctors, and someone said that they actually heard of such case. Okay? Actually, it wasn't one of the doctors, I shouldn't say. I don't know. I didn't do the research. I didn't Google it. I don't know. I can't speak to that. But the Gemara clearly, and it wasn't just the Gemara's medicine. There were other medical doctors, contemporary. Remember, the rabbis generally follow the best current medical assumptions of their day. Clearly, there was some concern for the possibility. I mean, seems unlikely. It's not, in principle, I think, medically implausible. It's just that the semen would have to penetrate deeply enough for this to happen, which does seem unlikely. But the Gemara actually has a case
maybe
in which
it was
it's
just
concerned.
A couple hiding in a corner.
What?
That seems more plausible.
Well, that's, by the way, I mean, in a very. But it's funny that you joke about this. By the way, it reminds me of another one of the many, many, many halachic issues that come up. You know, when a couple is undergoing fertility treatments, there are a lot of additional halachic questions. Some of them, for example, come up with Hilchot Shabbat. Because a woman has to undergo injections, and you actually is a question of you actually the needle that you actually have to almost construct it in a way. You have to almost create it, as it were, and then the injections. There's a whole halachic question about how to do that, and can you do it when a woman is anida, and the husband assisting physical interactions when she. And there's a whole host of issues there. And then you have another set of issues of when a couple is undergoing IVF, so they have to produce the semen, okay, typically within a certain time frame. I think it's like the semen remains viable for something like an hour and a half or something like that, last I understood from a few years ago. And so because of that concern, it's not enough for a couple, for example, to be. So one question is, how does the man produce it? Right? And we're going to talk about this. We'll see at least one source about this. Is consider wasting the seed. Okay, with this mature audience to intentionally ejaculate, to essentially, right, to cause oneself to, right, to masturbate, etc., to produce the semen, right, or in halacha, we prefer a couple being together, right, and actually, it's not uncommon in a lab for a couple to be together. There's a separate room often next door, right, and the couple actually has intercourse together. That's, and then they take any additional semen that comes out of the woman's body, and they use that, actually, assuming in certain, depending on the medical situation, but if the semen is in principle viable, then that what they'll do, but she has difficult carrying or what have you, right? Or they need to inject it into the woman, known as ICSI, you know, which is one of the earlier approaches that was developed. But these are all different options that came to be. And so halachically speaking, no, come on in. There's a pull up a chair over here if you'd like. Halachically speaking, this just reminds me, talk about the couple hiding in the corner. Another question that came up is a tznius question. You know, is that within a traditional community, you know, the doctor says, well, we have a room for that next door. You'll forgive me, right? Again, it's a mature audience. And so you go together, the couple's going to be together right over there. Everyone knows what's happening. You know, now on the one hand, you might say, yeah. No, not exactly private. Now, on the one hand, from the doctor's perspective, I mean, this is right. The doctor's like, this is like a clinical, you know, for them, this is like, they do this all the day. I know they're not, obviously not in the room. What? To the yichus, that's right. We got a lot of preference for this. So there, you know, so very often poskim say, look, it's not like you need have 10 minutes of viability. If you have an hour and a half, then, you know, go rent a hotel room. Forgive me, it's actually what poskim say. You don't have to tell anyone where it is. It'll just be in the same city. You know, sometimes for fully treatment, depending on where you live, you might have to go. So this is just, you know, rent a hotel room, or you don't have to tell anyone where you are. If it's local, it's local. You live there, fine. No one has to know anything. And then you just bring the sample, and no one has to know any differently. It's fascinating. So like these are actually...
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, it would be a lot more romantic.
I have never heard a couple say that there's anything romantic about any of this. It's a hard it's a very difficult experience, and this is not what you dream of and think about as a young couple. That's right. And certainly not how it's, you know, portrayed in the movies and so on and so forth. So it's a very, very, very hard thing, any which way. But it is. These are the kinds of questions that, that arise. But again, one of them is this question of paternity to come back. So in this Gemara, and actually the concern here has to do with, the details are not really so pertinent, but the general point is that we're actually concerned that the father's yichus would be carried through. Right? So if there's some lacking in the father's yichus or something like that, if a woman is impregnated from this essentially an anonymous father, right? Essentially sperm donor, unintentional sperm donor, basically. So then the child will carry that yichus. And that sounds like a very unusual case, and it is, but that has ramifications. Because what does that indicate? Although it might have been the obvious thing, that if someone donates the sperm, that although there was no physical intercourse between this male and this female, that nonetheless, the sperm donor is considered to be the halachic father. Now, that might have been relatively obvious, but now we're going to have to see, well, how far do we go with that, right? So, for example, in source 2 I gave you from the Bach. Bach is one of the commentaries on the Tzur, which is one of the classic halachic compendia. The Bach Rav Yoel Sirkis, living in the 17th century, has one of the best last names of any great rabbi that I know, Sirkis. Someone asked last night, well, how do you spell that? And I said, I said in English or in Polish? He wasn't exactly spelling his name in English. Anyhow, so he says, well, there was a medieval authority that picked up on this. Matzati b'hagot smak yashan miharav Rabinu Peretz. I found the old glosses of the Sefer Mitzvot Katan, which is one of the great medieval compendia again, who cites from Rabinu Peretz, who's one of the Ashkenazic Rishonim, medieval authorities. Shekata, who wrote, Isha Nida, if a woman is in her Nida status, Yicholah Lishkav, she is permitted, don't worry, she is permitted to sleep or to lie down, Asadine Ba'ala, even though she might become impregnated during her nida status by this concern of same concern of the semen somehow getting into her, right? That same concern seems unlikely, but again, let's go with it. V'niz harot, however, they should be careful, and this is before the assumptions that we have in terms of, you know, in terms of cleanliness and so on. Hygienic assumptions then were not exactly they are now. V'niz harot misadinim sheshechalav alehem ish acher. She should not lie on the bed sheets upon which another man lay, right? I know, sounds unusual. Pen titaber, lest she become impregnated. B'shichvat zera shel acher. And then he goes on and so on and so forth. In other words, we don't know whether that semen the yichus, we don't know anything about the father, right? So Jewish, not Jewish, Kohen, Levi, Israel, there are all sorts of different confusions that come in. And then he even asked the question, well, why aren't we worried about the husband? And he answers, well, there's this Ben Sira character who's part of the Apocrypha, and he was born from a Nida status, his parents, and he's still considered to be kosher. There's nothing to worry about. Basically, the husband there's no concern for, but the other another man we are concerned for. Now, again, this seems far-fetched, right? It seems strange. But if we take it and we apply it to the case of a sperm donor, what would this indicate? Whether it's the husband or not a husband. Halachically, what would this tell us about a sperm donor, presumably? That is that considered to be sufficient, even though there's no intercourse? Is a sperm donor considered to be a halachic father? And then for yichus implications, the answer would seem to be absolutely, yes, right? Which I think might be logical anyway, but then the question is, well, how far do we take that? So, for example, the third source, the Beit Shmuel, that we're going to see, asks the following question. We know that a man who is capable, at least, assuming that there's a halachic marriage and that there's physical capacity among the couple and there isn't sexual dysfunction, so on and so forth, a man has an obligation. The very first obligation listed in the Torah is the mitzvah of pru uravu, be fruitful and multiply. Well, does a sperm donor, whether it's a couple or a man who's not married to this woman, but a Jewish man, does such a man fulfill the obligation of pru uravu? Take the easy case, okay? We need to. I can't somehow, right, there's a dysfunction. The man is not able to ejaculate the sperm in a way that she's able to become impregnated. So what do we do? So we're going to take his sperm and even just, again, in the injection into her body, let's just say. So does he fulfill the mitzvah of pru urvu? Well, if this is his child, so then presumably the answer is?
Yes, sure.
Sure, why not? Now, let's say they're not married and it's a sperm donor. Now, sperm donor is a Jewish man. It's not a far from simple matter, but let's just say it happens. Does that man fulfill pru urvu?
Sure.
With this woman who's not, to whom he's not married, right? And there's no other relation. Well, yeah, perhaps the again should be the same answer. And indeed, in source 3, that's exactly what we find. Kata v'chelka mechokek. The mechelka mechokek wrote, yesh lehistapek, I mistranslated this, I apologize. There's a doubt. Isha shenitabra be'ambati. The same case. A woman, it says, sorry, I wrote, who gives birth? It's a good one. And if you think that's fun, it's funny. I know 1, 2, 3 women who have done this, who've given birth in a bathtub. Okay, anyone have any friends who did this? Okay.
There was a method of giving birth.
Intentional.
Yes.
Right, but a natural type of birth. Yeah. Right. I know what I'm talking about. No, I know women who have intentionally done in a bit. Right. Right, but I mean, what I'm talking about is not that. I'm actually talking about women who.
Accidentally.
What? Who are, right. No. Yeah, that's what this means. No, but right now I'm talking about women who accidentally, not people who preferred a natural birth. They intended to go to the hospital, but they actually found the child born when they went to the restroom. I know 3 instances of that from 2 different women. Okay. Yes, it happened to 1 person I know. Twice, yeah, but that's a mistranslation here. It means someone who became impregnated in a bathtub. So he says, "Ima'av kiim pruruvu." Does the father fulfill the mitzvah of bearing children? Right? V'im nikra b'del l'chol davar. Does it call his child for every matter in every respect? So he says, "Well, now I have a proof." Going back to these 2 sources that we saw, v'yesh lahavi raya. He says it can bring a proof. From the glosses of the smock that we wrote, that we just saw, that a woman is warned against lying in linen upon wood, right, and so on and so forth. Exactly what we just said. If you take a look in the Hebrew, the last line, nishma, right, from this we derive the havi benola chol davar, that this is that he is his son in every single respect. Right, so now what we've said is that the sperm donor is the father in every regard, whether with regard to yichus, whether with regard to pru urvu, absolutely. Now, in source 4, another one of the classic commentators, the Taz, the Turei Zahav, cites the Chelka Mechokek, another commentary on the Tur, who's also one of the Achronim, is one of the later, maybe roughly 16th, 17th century authorities. He's not 100% sure. He says, maybe not. He says, yesh lehistapik. He says, I'm not 100% sure. Maybe yes, maybe no. He says, sorry, the Chalka Mechokek was cited as the opinion that says it's absolutely 100% the child. But the Taz says, if you look on the 4th line in the Hebrew, right after the 3 dots, says, Ve'in Zeraya, he says, it's not such a proof. Right? There's no proof from here. Deshema l'chumra aminan l'kulo lo aminan. Bifrap imidi t'tali b'kom ma'asai. V'hin d'intabra mi'atzma d'ino yotzu yaze. He says, there's no proof from here. For perhaps we say this stringently, but not necessarily leniently. This is especially in a matter that depends on positive action. In other words, it's one thing to say that if you had intention and you contributed on purpose, that would be one thing. She impregnated herself, in which case he does not fulfill his requirement. But, he says, maybe here, where it's accidental, I'm not so sure. Okay. So to summarize, what we have is that at least in the case of an accidental birth, one opinion says the Gemara seems to indicate that it's your child. One opinion says that, 100% for Yichus and for Puravu. And the Taz says, at least if it's not intentional, I'm not so convinced.
This is like a tricky.
Right?
I mean, to say, women have, get pregnant by accident. So that's not going to apply to this, but it makes it sound like it does.
He probably means not just unintentional, but right, he's talking about it doesn't take place naturally at all. So you're right, a combination of, it doesn't mean a woman who, right? That doesn't mean that, right? Birth control didn't quite work out.
Right.
That's not what we mean. What we're talking about here is probably a combination of it being external to the physical body, into the typical manner thereof.
Is that possible?
in addition to a lack of intentionality.
Does anybody know if that's even
so
possible?
I haven't.
Possible?
So I don't know, but I mean, I don't know what current scientific consensus is. I didn't even look. And the reason I didn't look is because for me, I think for us, it's less about whether or not these actual cases are plausible. But the point is that a post-sig who's operating in 2018 can look at these and can say, whatever the scientific assumptions were then, we can extract principles that are strikingly contemporary. And that's where we're going to go.
What's the punishment for a child who's born from time when the mother was in Nida?
There's no punishment. It's a great question. It's not a punishment. The Gemara just seems to say that it's not the best. Right, exactly. It's not the ideal status, but there are not concrete halachic ramifications in a traditional sense. Okay, so that seems to, I think it's amazing. You have this Gemara, it's just like far-flung, is it even plausible case, and all of a sudden the post-Gemara discussing it, long before contemporary fertility treatments. And then fast forward to 30 years ago, and the post can say, 40 years ago, the post can say, oh my goodness, this seemed wild, it seemed crazy. It's not wild and crazy anymore, at least not in, you know, in the Petri dish. It's not in the case of today. Now, this then in turn raises a whole host of questions. One question that it raises is the question of, I'll mention at this point, is, well, then, if this is permissible for a husband and a wife, and it's considered to be your child, so it's the whole question of how you produce the sperm that I mentioned earlier.
Right? So sperm...
Like, what's the halachic? Forget the question of, like, hotel room versus, you know, the lab. I just mean, is a couple have to be together traditionally, or what if that's not going to work, right?
There's a sperm donor considered the father.
So, right, well, according to this, the answer is yes.
So
that's what it would
like,
seem.
Kind of unnerving.
Some theories of it not being a Jewish donor make sense because of this whole business.
So that's the argument. That's exactly, and that's sort of Moshe Feinstein prefers a non-Jewish sperm donor because he says you're not going to have any confusion. He says this is clearly a Jewish child because we follow the mother. Right. It's clearly not a Kohen or a Levi because there's no father to transmit that status. Mm-hmm. Right? If the argument, if you assume that there's a question of, well, maybe it should be a mamzer because it's coming from an illicit relation, but let's assume no, that comes, either that's irrelevant because that's only in more severe cases, or that comes through physical intercourse, let's assume, not through just a donation. So therefore, maybe there's an argument to be said, and that's exactly his argument. That's just less complicated than non-Jewish donor. That's exactly his argument. Okay, now in terms of the question of wasting seed, let's say a couple is not able to, there's a sexual dysfunction, and the only way to generate the seed is through other forms. So there are a lot of different things that can be done. There's physical, sometimes the husband is still able to physically arouse himself. There might be a sexual dysfunction between the two, right? But he's actually able to ejaculate on his own through that. So is that permissible, right, halachically, right? There are other things that they do. They actually can do their electronic stimulants, of course, and there are even ways of putting a person under and then stimulating a person while he's sleeping. That's actually one of the methods that has been used in recent years, depending on the scenario. And there's a huge literature, we're not going to go through all of this, but I had to include source number 5. The reason I had to include source number 5 is because this comes from through marriage, not a blood relative, but a relative of my wife. This is from the Responsa Emek Halacha. His name is Rabbi Yoshua Baumol, and I want to say this is my wife's great, great uncle, I think. He wrote two volumes, Baumol, Baumel. At least in English, and he wrote two volumes of Responsa, which are available online also in various online formats that you can find Responsa. And so if there's an opportunity to include it, I wanted to take that opportunity. And he basically says in source number 5, he says, well, is this considered to be wasting seed? That's always the question, right? That's the halachic category. Motzi shichvat zera levatala. So he says, well, let's go back to the views that we saw. According to the opinion that it's a fulfillment of Pru Ravu, this is not wasteful. You're not wasting seed. This is productive. And then he says, and even according to the view that it's not a fulfillment of Puruvu, or that you're not sure it's a fulfillment of Puruvu, it's still considered to be productive. He says, well, maybe technically the father doesn't get a mitzvah check. You can't check off Puruvu. But you're bringing a child into the world. This is a productive act. This is not someone who's just, this is not for the sake of, you know, of just enjoyment, of pure pleasure, and so on and so forth. It's innocuous, and it's not just innocuous, it's invaluable. So he says, in his opinion, it's certainly not levatala, according to all views. Now, my eyes are on the clock. So just so you know, we're gonna stop here for today. What we have outstanding is many things. We have to look not just at paternity, but at maternity, which we're gonna start to look at hopefully next time. But we also have outstanding here question of, okay, wait a second. If you think that it is a fulfillment of Puruvu is not an option, it's an obligation. So do we obligate couples who are having difficult, you know, to say like they have to go through this treatment, right? I mean, that's now an extreme on the other side, right? So maybe the opportunity of IVF should be, right, the insistence upon undergoing, or that far we don't go. Rav Moshe Feinstein is on that, in on that. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. And then we're going to have to look at also the parameters of PGD, right? Of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, is that okay for, you know, T-Sachs and for Beck and so on and so forth, and Huntington's, et cetera, and so on and forth? Well, if you say that, then where do you draw the line? What if I want to choose to have a boy because we've had five girls and I really want a boy, or vice versa? Well, what if I say, no, I have a halachic guardian, because, you know, according to halacha, really, you need a boy and a girl to fulfill Puruvu. I already have one gender or the other. It's not a designer baby. It's just for the sake of Puruvu. Okay? It's a halachic baby. Okay? There you go. And let's say they really mean that genuinely. Let's say it's a pious couple, and that's really what they mean. They're not just being, you know, facetious about it. So these are all some of the questions we'll, God willing, have the opportunity to continue to consider as we move ahead. Yeah.
Putting out garlic.
Yeah. Is it 7:30?
7:30.
Yeah. Quite a responsibility to be.
Oh my goodness.
Oh my goodness. Not that I didn't know that before, but I
I didn't mention this about Rabbi Weitzman, but in his office he has pictures of babies, of families to whom he helps.
Oh.
He sent him pictures, and his office
what
has many pictures of babies.
What a mixer, right? What a mixer,
very, very special.
Yeah. When I next come,
can you
the first one on this
Oh, yeah. Just remind me.
Can I record bullying?
Sure.